stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
Yes, you are on breakfast here on 2SER. And breakfast is that time where you sit down, maybe around the kitchen table, or maybe even in the car on the way to work with a little bit of toast, maybe some Vegemite, a little bit of butter, maybe some Avo over the top. It is, you know, the thing that kicks off your day. But what would you have been eating maybe 50, 100, even 200 years ago for breakfast? I'm joined by Jackie Newling now. She's the author of a book called Eat Your History. It is a painstaking recreation of all these lost recipes from Australian history. And she is a self-described gastronomer. And so looking at these recipes for breakfast all the way back to 1788. Jackie joins me now. Good morning, Jackie.
G'day, Jamie.
Have you had breakfast this morning?
Funnily enough, I had the avocado and Vegemite toast.
Oh, quintessentially Aussie, huh?
It seems that way.
So, Jackie, you are a colonial gastronomer of sorts. So that means you look at you're looking at the food from that period in Australian history where it all kind of kicked off, or when Brits came over.
Exactly.
What were we eating in 1788 for breakfast?
For breakfast, well, you're probably lucky if you had breakfast for a lot of people. When you think that 70% of the population were convicts, so we're talking the sort of the first fleet. Another 30% was marines, so, you know, the soldiers that had to supervise the convicts. And then you had a very small part of the community who were the sort of toffs, you know, they were the officers and that sort of thing.
Mm.
So at that point, convicts pretty much just lived like everybody else. They just had to fend for themselves. They started off just in tents and then, you know, gradually built their own huts and things. So it was, they all had rations.
Mm-hmm.
So flour they could turn into bread, sort of damper style, or you know, made into sort of bread loaves. Salt pork, dried peas, so you'd have a bit of pea and ham soup going on.
So I imagine these are things that they would have brought with them over on the boat. You're talking salt pork there, dried peas. I mean, those are things that that could have been stored for that long voyage to Australia.
Exactly. So they underpinned the diet. Then it was really up to people to then go foraging in the bush, which they did, for fresh greens and you know, fresh food.
Mm.
And they even found themselves a native leaf, a native herb that they used for tea. So even, you know, even in 1788, tea was, you know, a social staple, if you like.
Mm.
So tea wasn't part of the rations in those days. It was still classed as sort of a privilege. So
yeah.
What did they do? They went and found an alternative.
Well, that's so interesting you say that, because you look at now, there is a resurgence in using native Australian greens and herbs and berries and things like that. But that's only recent. But back in 1788, they were doing that.
They definitely were. So, they really had to do that because it takes a while. You know, they were there to, they planted gardens and established farms and things, but of course it takes a while for those things to grow and to happen.
Mm.
So for at least the first 9 months, you find Governor Phillips saying in about September that, you know, the gardens are coming along and we now have no need for the native greens.
And that was the way it was until about 2014.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it, how we started
that. And I suppose that the growing conditions there would be so different to what they were used to. You know, you're in a completely different hemisphere, completely different climate. And so trying to grow the things that worked in the UK might not necessarily have worked here.
That's true. There was a lot of trial and error.
Mm.
But they also, they didn't just stick to things that they brought from the UK. They stopped in at Rio de Janeiro on the way and at the Cape of Good Hope, which is sort of South Africa.
Mm.
So they picked up things that grew in the warmer climates and southern hemisphere as well. But you're right, some of them, you know, they weren't necessarily things that people were used to.
Mm.
One of the things that grew really well here was maize. So corn, you know, good old corn on the cob.
Oh, yes.
Bit
of butter.
So, yeah, well, there wasn't a lot of butter around. The few cows they brought with them escaped and weren't seen for 7 years. So,
we had wild cows.
So, that's why we've got an area out near Camden called the Cow Pastures. That's
really
where they escaped to. So, yeah, so there wasn't much butter in the colony, but not for the first few years. But
did they have chooks? Would there have been eggs with breakfast? You know, soldiers and dunkers?
Yes.
Okay.
There certainly would have been those sort of things. But the corn, in the end, the maize meal, they sort of ground it down to sort of like a polenta type thing. And that they would use to make a porridge, which was called hominy.
Right.
Which was something that was done by the American, in fact, they called it Indian corn because of the American Indians.
Right.
And hominy was something that was that the slaves, the African slaves in America used to have as a meal. So it was sort of like a polenta porridge.
Mm.
And when Hyde Park Barracks was built in the 1830s, or sorry, late 1810s, that was what they got for breakfast.
Right. Okay.
Soupy corn porridge, and they loathed it.
Gruel. It's your
it's
slop.
Gruel. Exactly.
Yeah, it's all a bit Oliver Twist, isn't it?
Bit.
Yeah, if you've just joined us, I'm here with Jackie Newling from Sydney Living Museums. She's their resident gastronomer. And we're talking about brekkie and food in 1788. So we were speaking there about, you know, what the convicts ate, which was basically anything they could get their hands on. What about the tops? What about the upper crust? What were they having for breakfast?
So I've got a wonderful menu from 1812, which was given to a young Maria MacArthur. So she married into the MacArthur family and moved out here to Australia to set up house. She was 19 and had to run her own household. So her sort of benevolent aunt or godmother wrote her this long, long letter about, you know, how to manage your house, how to manage your servants, but also how to entertain. And so we've got this fabulous sort of menu suggestion for a sociable breakfast because... Mm-hmm. If you think about it, when people, you know, these days we might pop in somewhere for an hour or two and then pop out again.
Yes.
Back in those days, when you had to ride a horse and carriage and your nearest neighbour might be an hour or so away, or Sydney was a day's ride or away.
You made the stay worth it.
You tend to stay. So people often had house guests. But this is really quite... quite lavish, but quite practical. So you've got things like eggs, of course, that we would still imagine, and fruit, and, you know, bread rolls and butter, because they were wealthy enough to have their own cow and made their own butter.
Mm.
But then they had things like lobster or prawns.
What?
A ham, sliced tongue. So tongue's something that was popular right through to the outdoor, through to the
thankfully that's disappeared.
1950s, but it dropped away after the Second World War. Tongue was quite a prestigious dish.
Wow.
Prepared the way sort of corned beef is done.
Yeah, right. So it's kind of sliced silver side.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Whole chickens, and then they would have hot chocolate.
Oh, come
with
on.
Their breakfast.
So you've got a roast chook on one side, you've got tongue on the other, you've got a bit of eggs, and you've got some hot chockey.
Eggs and ham, yep, some prawns.
would there be tea with breakfast?
You could have either tea or hot chocolate. They were the sort of breakfast drinks.
Right. This is long before the days of coffee.
Look, coffee was around too, but that was more a blokey drink.
Right.
So ladies would have tea or hot chocolate.
Wow. See, I always get paid out because my coffee order is a double piccolo, and people say that's a girly order. So I'm going to say, no, coffee's blokey, mate. Oh, it's just, this is fascinating. I mean, I love the idea. Jackie, look, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Could we get you on in the future and maybe go through some of these different, because you've done from 1788 all the way through to the 1950s. Could we get you on and look at some different periods over this time?
Yeah, sure, that'd be fun.
Because I just think this is great. Another question without notice, someone has tweeted at us, Laura Carolina has tweeted, and I don't know if you can answer this, she said, if Vegemite or avocado goes on the toast first, is there a correct way?
I'm a Vegemite first.
You're a Vegemite first?
Yeah, because I love the feeling of your teeth just sinking into the avocado and then you hit that nice salty sort of edge underneath.
All right, no, I think you're spot on there. Laura, there you go. So Vegemite first, then the avo on top.
It's not just what you eat, it's how you eat it as well.
Absolutely. Well, Jackie, it's been fascinating talking to you. This book of yours, Eat Your History, looks amazing. I'd love to get you on next week, okay?
Thanks very much, Jamie. That'd be good.
Wonderful. Okay, Jackie Newling there. She's the author of this book, Eat Your History, and it is this painstaking recreation of lost recipes from 1788 all the way up until the 1950s, and she's done it for Sydney Living Museums. It's a cracker, and we're going to get her on next week, and we'll progress in the history of the colony. We'll move a little bit beyond the early colonization, and we'll figure out what they were eating after a little while after that.